Coming up, we got Albert Gim from No Ceilings talking about the NBA draft. We're talking about predictions for the draft 1 week from today, as well as some of my favorite player comparisons in this year's draft class. Let's talk some more NBA draft with Albert Gim from No Ceilings. Albert, how are you?
I'm living the life right now. It's the busiest time of the year, but also the most exciting time.
It is the best time of the year. The finals just wrapped up. Draft literally only 1 week away. And so with only 1 week to go until the NBA draft, we're going to start off today's show with some predictions. 1 week to go, Albert. What's your first prediction for the 2026 NBA draft?
This might not be like the craziest of predictions, but I'm a big Keaton Wongler fan from Illinois. And there seems to be a lot of smoke about him, you know, being pretty popular with the Clippers. But at the same time, I am also wondering if he isn't taken there at five by the Clippers, could there be a little bit of a fall with him where he kind of slips down a little bit, maybe even past 10 is something that I've started to wonder just because, and my reasoning for it is after watching the NBA finals, I do wonder if there might be a slight overreaction to the physicality of what we just watched between the Knicks and the Spurs, where teams start going like, okay, like everyone on the floor was able to be physical and play with physicality. And maybe teams might wonder, okay, he's 6'6", 188. Can he handle the physicality of the NBA? Me personally, I don't think so. I do think so, because watching him in person, watching all his film, obviously, I feel like, yeah, he is skinny. But he plays through contact. He plays with physicality. If you watch some of his drives to the rim throughout the season, yeah, there are times where, you know, way bigger guys are pushing him off his driving lanes and giving him a hard time. But he had a free throw rate of 47.6%. He shot 80% from the line. He was just under six attempts per game. A guy who really worked his way to the rim using craft, using spin moves, using change of tempos. And I just think like there might be a slight overreaction to the finals where they go, oh, we're worried about him being skinnier. But for me, I think he plays with more physicality than people give him credit for. So I wouldn't want him to fall, and I could see him going top five. But I do wonder if NBA teams might feel differently.
Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, this is smokescreen season. There's a lot of misdirection. There's contrasting information out there. I know Jeremy Wu reported that the Clippers like Wongler last week. I said that they're not head over heels in love with him. So like, who knows where the truth actually is? It's just all things we're hearing and all things we're putting out there. But what is factual is that Keaton Wongler's camp canceled a workout with the Brooklyn Nets. So that happened. We know he canceled a workout with the Nets. We know he's working out this week with the Sacramento Kings, as I reported last week on my NBA draft guide. So at least Wongler's camp doesn't necessarily feel a need to shut down workouts. He's not shutting things down. He doesn't feel a level of certainty that he'll be the fifth pick. There's a chance he slides to at least seven to Sacramento. There's a chance he could slip a little further to Atlanta at eight or Dallas at nine. I'd imagine he still goes in the top 10, Albert. I don't see him slipping outside the top 10. I think Dallas would take him. I think Milwaukee at 10 could take him. But you never know. Things happen, right? Like if those teams say, we want a forward, we want Nate Amen, we want Kareem Lopez, or we want a center, we want a Dai Mara, that's how these guards can fall. But it does seem the most likely scenario is that we see a run of guards, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then Dallas hopes one is still there for them besides the teeny tiny Kingston Fleming. So I do think there's a chance Wongler falls. And one of the reasons why I think there's a chance of this leads to my next prediction here. The Kings will have to trade up for Darius Acuff. I think at five, the Clippers or whoever trades into that spot, or six, the Nets have a strong probability of taking Acuff and trying to just get as many assets from the Kings as they possibly can to assure that Sacramento gets Acuff, if the Kings indeed do want Acuff as much as it seems like literally everybody in the NBA thinks they do.
I think with Acuff, I totally agree with that. And he's a guy that my partner Corey Tulliba and I, No Ceilings, we got to see him up close and personal, obviously Nike Hoop Summit the year before, but also recently at the P3 Sports Labs in Santa Barbara. And the allure with him, I totally get it, right? He's a powerful, compact guard, can score all three levels, is a really good passer. And the biggest thing with Acuff is that he answered a lot of questions. I think heading into his freshman season, a lot of people were worried, like, oh, is he just going to be like a score first guard who's going to need the ball in his hands all the time? Now, he did have the ball in his hands a ton at Arkansas. But I think the thing with Acuff is that he doesn't have to be that way. And for a team like Brooklyn, you know, if they're interested, if all these teams, the Clippers, whatever, the interesting thing with him is he's more versatile than people give him credit for. Like, he is such a good off-ball shooter, a guy who plays with a lot of IQ. He's a really smart player. Obviously, like, the highlight stuff is all the stuff he's doing with the ball in his hands, but he's a guy that I think could play off-ball a little bit as well. And if he ends up with a team like Brooklyn that has a Yegor Yeoman, who in his rookie season was more of like a floor spacer-ish, but a guy in college who, you know, really flashed the playmaking potential, you put Acuff next to a Yeoman and the type of playmaking shooting that they offered together, I think is really, really exciting. So yeah, like, he's smaller, but with Acuff, he's so physically ready too. Like, when we saw him working out at P3, like, it looked like he was Captain America. Like, they gave him the superhuman serum. He was so jacked and ripped, and he looked so ready for the physicality of the NBA game that I can totally understand teams being like, yeah, he's smaller, but he's ready for the league, and he has all the requisite skills you want from like a modern day point guard.
What probability would you give it that Utah at number two, after working out Darius Acuff, after working out Michael Brown, decides to trade out of the two spot to five or six and takes Acuff or Brown there?
For me, I would put it below 10%, just because okay. It does feel like Utah is just enamored with Boozer. And everyone talks about like the dad part of it, but also like Boozer is such a winner, and we're coming off the NBA finals where Jalen Brunson showed the world like heart over height, over talent, over everything. And like, winning is a skill, and Cameron Boozer is a serial winner, a guy who's won at every single level. And, you know, having his dad in the front office doesn't hurt. So I do feel like that's more of a possibility. Obviously Darren Peterson is in the mix as well, but I would probably say below 10%.
I think below 10% as well, but I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued by the possibility. Just given the fact that, I mean, they're turning over every stone. They're not just locked into these top three guys. They're exploring all possibilities, and this is a Ainge-run front office that has never had any fear in making big, ballsy decisions. So I just look forward to, I like thinking about these outside-the-box possibilities that are debated within front offices that almost never, ever happen, but sometimes they do. Speaking about debates, the number one pick, Albert, this is my next prediction here, related to some of the news right now this week. We got a reporting yesterday from Shams Charania and Jeremy Wu that Darren Peterson decided that he's only going to work out for the number one team. They also added that both Darren Peterson and AJ DiBonsa think they're going to go number one. And it seems to me we are building towards a year like when the Orlando Magic drafted Paolo Banchero, and people thought it might be Jabari Smith or it might be Chet Holmgren. Banchero is going to fall to number three to the Houston Rockets. Nope. They took Banchero on draft day. I think my next prediction here is we're not going to know who the Wizards take until the day of the draft. It's going to remain a mystery until next Tuesday. That's my prediction over this coming week, that they're just going to keep it all a secret. And then the gambling, you know, the prediction markets move like crazy on Tuesday morning, and we get an idea of who it's going to be.
I think that's totally fair. And I like the comparison you made to the Banchero year, just because, like, we have, in my mind, I think we have four guys who could go number one, including Caleb Wilson, right? Like, we have that type of top tier talent. And with Peterson, he's a guy that I've had at number one since like November. And I've kept him there just because I feel like obviously he had a strange year and there are real questions about the health, blah, blah, blah. But the type of talent that we're talking about here, he's an absolute freak. And he's got the mentality. I get it. He's not like a loud, boisterous guy who's going to say a ton to the media, but I mean, he's a killer, is exactly what he is. And the skill set with the athleticism, there's a lot to like. I'll say, with AJ, a guy who we've seen a bunch in person, Corey and I got to see him working out at LMU a couple weeks back before the combine. AJ's really worked on his game, and he is a scary competitor. I mean, we saw him work out, and throughout the whole workout, he was completely locked in. He's got this like bulldog competitive mentality. The thing that we really liked watching AJ work out is that he's really worked on his outside jumper, and he's working with Zach Gonzalez, the guy who worked with Yegor Yeoman before the draft last year and helped him clean up his shooting mechanics. And AJ's jumper is looking way better. The balance is better. The base is stronger. The arc is good. So to think about what AJ was able to do in his freshman season there at BYU with his mid-range scoring ability, his growth as a passer, and then he's going to become a more reliable outside shooter plus the size and athleticism, it's terrifying. And I totally get it. And so if I was Washington, I'd be really stressed out right now too about this pick because there's so many good players of Cam Boozer, Caleb Wilson as well. So I think your prediction is a good one because it is a really tough pick to make.
Give me the argument for why Caleb Wilson belongs in that top four argument. It's why it's actually a top four and not a top three.
I think when you, obviously it sucks that he got hurt right down the stretch, but with Caleb, if you take the size, the physicality that he plays with, the athleticism that he has, the potential three-level scoring that he has, and also he's another one of these like freak competitors, right? To be compared to KG, like I don't think that's thrown around lightly. I know you see it a lot on the internet, but I don't think it's just something that people throw out there lazily. He is potentially that type of prospect where he is able to combine the mentality with the physical gifts and the power that he has. I just think there's so much there. And also, if you turn on his high school tape, something that he got to show a lot more in high school is his playmaking ability. He's a really, really good passer. And the fact that he can pair that type of passing with his athleticism, scoring ability, you know, from the mid-range, which is a big part of his game, and around the rim, I'm a believer in his outside shot eventually developing. I don't think he'll ever be a 40% shooter, but if he can get to 34 to 36% from outside and what he can do in the mid-range, obviously freak defender with the length that he has, you put all that together and he definitely deserves to be at least in the discussion, I think.
I think he has a wider range of outcomes than Boozer, Peterson, and Ibanza. But I do think his ceiling is similarly as high as those guys. And like, because sometimes just the things you see him do in these stretches of games, like at Duke, like at Kansas, where the shot's falling and the ball's in his hands, and you're like, and he's bringing the ball up the floor coast to coast, and you're like, huh, is that Giannis Jr.? Is that who that is? Like, it's just sometimes you just see this megastar in Caleb Wilson, and knowing how hard he works and how good of a kid he is too. Like, I think he's a really good kid you want to bet on. That's why I think with somebody like him, I forgive sometimes the aloof moments defending off ball, because it's like he plays hard, he puts in effort, yep. He's a good kid. These are things that in all likelihood he'll get over and improve on over time. There's a chance Caleb Wilson isn't the fourth best player in this draft class 10 years from now. When we look back at it, there's a chance he's number one or number two. I would not rule that out. Albert, what's your next prediction?
This might be a little bit of a spicier one, but I think Abuka Okori from Stanford, I think he could potentially go top 10. My reasoning for that is if you look at the pure talent that he has, yeah, I get it. He's like a 6'3 guard, but he put up 23 points per game at Stanford. It's not like he was playing at some tiny no-name school. And also like 3 assists per game. And I think people look at that and be like, okay, three assists. Why am I impressed by that? But if you turn on the film, he's got real passing chops. Like some of the stuff that he's doing, because as a defense, you're so worried about the three-level scoring with him and his ability to slash to the rim that, you know, defenses in college were overreacting and shifting over to him. But some of the reads that he was making on the second side, weak side stuff, driving hard to the rim, throwing hook passes to the weak side corner, right? Him attacking pick and rolls and with the threat of the mid-range shot, bigs coming up to him, him finding guys in the pocket at the dunker spot. There's some really good passing stuff with him that I think people are not talking about. And when you take that potential plus his gifts plus his production as a freshman, and then you start to think like teams around like 8 to 9, right? Like if you're Dallas and you're looking at Braden Burries and you go, well, Braden Burries is a little bit older, right? And I can grab Abuka Okori, who just put 23 points per game at Stanford and also is a good passer. I could see him running the offense with Cooper Flagg. Then you start to get excited. He's also a plus-plus athlete as well. And so, I don't know. I think the talent plus production is just so exciting with him that I think NBA teams could talk themselves into potentially taking him in the top 10. I'm not saying it'll definitely happen, but I think there's something to talk about there.
I do too. I mean, I'm not sure who he's worked out for, but I know Christian Anderson, as an example, another guard in the similar lump of prospects, has worked out for some teams with picks in the late top 10. Those teams may also have picks in the 20s too. I'm talking about like Dallas, for example, 9 and 30, or Atlanta, 8 and 23. And one of these guard needy teams, I can easily see them talking themselves into Okorie for all of the reasons you stated. I think you're spot on correct about the playmaking ability. I mean, only 16 of his shots last year at Stanford were assisted. He had to do literally everything with the ball in his hands. And while doing everything, he showed off a lot of talent as a passer, and a lot of those passes resulted in bricks. And at the NBA level, that may be a very different result than it was at Stanford for him. He had a very low turnover rate as well. It was only 11.9%. with him on the floor at Stanford. It was 20.5% with him off the floor, according to CBB Analytics, and that is the largest drop-off in the entire nation. So he kept, when he's on the floor, they didn't turn it over. And also, people talk about sometimes the shooting with him. He made only 34% of his threes, but he also made 83% of his free throws. He made over 50% of his floaters. I'm betting on Ibuka Okorie to become a highly reliable shooter, possibly even a knockdown shooter. He had a game-winning pull-up three against Virginia Tech. He had a lefty offhand floater in the final minute against UNLV. He's just got so much skill. He doesn't play with any fear. He's so confident. And he's smart. He went to Stanford. I'm buying Ibuka Okorie stock is what I'm trying to say. And I have him higher on my board than I do in my mocks because I like these guards, you know, Bennett Sturts, Christian Anderson, all these guys in that range, they're mid-lottery to mid-20s. I don't know who's going to go where. Filon might be the guy that goes in the lottery. Filon might be the guy that goes in the 20s. I don't know. All I know is when I look at these guys and stack them up, Okorie's the guy where I'm like, if I didn't know where their background, nothing in high school, they're just a blank slate. Okorie's the guy I'm like, wow. 50% of his shots at the rim, and he could be a shooter, and he's clutch, and he's athletic, and he could pass. Why is he not a top 10 pick? And maybe he will be at the end of the day, right? Things change over the next week, yep. Albert, right? Like, we didn't know Yegor Demin was going to go top 10 to Brooklyn a week prior to the draft, and then boom, it happens.
Yeah, I mean, anything truly is possible, and especially when we're talking about a class like this that has so much high-end talent, and then things kind of thin out a little bit, right? And so there might be a lot of teams that want to get ahead of that and, you know, trade up or maybe even reach a little bit to get their guy. It's definitely possible. And I think especially with Okorie, I get it. Like, sometimes we take counting stats and we go like, oh, maybe we shouldn't overreact, whatever. It's still crazy to average 23 points per game as a freshman. To your point, like the load that he had to deal with as a freshman is no joke. And so, once again, a lot of these teams are going to be thinking about so many different scenarios. And also, we haven't even talked about, like, with the Giannis stuff and all the different trade possibilities. Who knows what the landscape actually looks like a week from now, where the Bucks might have 3 first-round picks. And then we have no idea what happens from there. So there's a lot up in the air. And that's why we kind of have to open our minds to some variance here.
And we'll be right back after this break. Next prediction. The Thunder will move up to the 9th, 10th, or 11th pick. That's my sense of they may be trying to move up. I don't know how far, maybe as far up as 5 or 6. That might be a bit hard to do. Might be a bit high of a price to pay. But to me, I think if they want to move up a few spots to assure they get their guy, whoever that might be. Adai Mara is who people speculate it is, but do you ever really know what the Thunder are going to do? The answer is no. You don't actually know what the Thunder are trying to do, but whoever it is that Sam Presti and the Thunder desire, they have the ammo to go out and go get that guy, and I think they're going to do it, whether it's combining 12 and 17 alone or whether it's 12 and 17 and another future pick to move way up. But my prediction is the Thunder do move up in the draft.
I really like that one, but I kind of want to flip it and ask you, if you know, gun to your head, if you had to answer this, who do you feel like, considering everything, right, where they are in their timeline, their history in the draft, who do you think is like a prospect that kind of fits that mold that you think they'd be targeting in that range from 9 to 11?
I want a big jumbo center, and I want a Adai Mara. if I'm the Thunder. I know they just drafted Thomas Sorber 1 year ago. They still have Isaiah Hartenstein under contract. They still have Chet Holmgren, but I want a big 7'3" dude with skill who could potentially be a successor to Isaiah Hartenstein as well, given his playmaking feel, his ability to facilitate, run dribble handoffs, and make quick decisions. To me, Mara fits what they're missing. At the same time, like if you stay at number 12, you know, you could also use a big forward too, like a Merez Johnson type, a Jaxel Lendenborg. There's guys at 12 that make sense to me. And so I think there's also logic to just staying at 12 and just trading out of 17 and turning that into future picks as well. But ultimately, with all the ammo that they already have, there's some logic to moving up. Why do you feel a little differently about who they possibly should target?
I think all three Michigan guys make a ton of sense. I think for me, I've just had so much trouble with Adai Mara because I saw him up close and personal at UCLA for 2 years, and I was at a ton of those games. And watching him at times was really, really frustrating, both like during games and even like pregame stuff. But I get it. Like playing at UCLA is, it's tough. It's tough. And what we saw him do at Michigan is really important. And that's probably the most important thing with his eval. He had a great season, very productive. I mean, the minutes per game stuff, like, I get it. I think he's going to be one of these guys where maybe you treat him like the Knicks do with like Mitchell Robinson. I'm not saying they're the same player, but you kind of have him like on a minutes restriction a little bit early on just to make sure that you're keeping him healthy and like in good shape. That might be something that they'd have to do, but you can't teach 7'3". Like, that's a real thing. And in a world where you have to defend this alien that plays in San Antonio, Victor Wembanyama, having a 7'3 guy like Mara with the weight that he has, he's like, what, 260, right? So that's important. And the fact that he is a wizard of a passer, like, that's some really special stuff. And so I totally get that. Just for me, I love Merez Johnson, and I just feel like he's a guy that makes a ton of sense with what they need. And, you know, with the Hartenstein situation being what it is, and maybe he's not there next season or in 2 years, whatever, having a guy like Merez with his ability on the defensive end of the ball, like I think he's a really special lateral mover for a guy his size. And I think there's real offensive upside with him as a shooter. Watching him shoot at the combine, I was like, oh, I'm a believer. Like, the form looks good. The mechanics look repeatable. I'm like, he may not be a lights out shooter right now, but in a couple of years, he might become a really reliable one. So I just feel like what he offers defensively and with the upside offensively, and the fact that, you know, he's such a dog and he's going to play all the time, I think that's exciting. But I could see it with both guys.
What's your next prediction, Albert?
My next one is around Koa Pete. Koa Pete's a player that I really like. And he didn't have the freshman season that a lot of people thought he was going to have, especially early on when he was unbelievable, 30-point games, blah, blah, blah. He might really fall in this class. And the reason why is obviously because, number one, he didn't have the season, you know, 14 points per game, whatever. But he was a winning player, is my counter to that. But he, at the combine, the jumper reconstruction is rough. And I think the timing of things was very strange to me. The fact that they decided to reconstruct his jumper right before the combine, and then at the combine, he showed everyone where he's at in that process. It was really tough to watch, like where he was gathering the ball, where he was releasing it. Like, everything was very strange. But for me, I think right now he might fall to like the mid to late 20s is a real possibility. And that's unfortunate because I think he's really good. And for where I'm landing is, if I'm the Knicks and I'm there at 24, I keep the pick, which, you know, the Knicks don't always do. But if they kept the pick at 24 and Koa Pete was on the board, I'd have a really difficult time passing him up because you know what you're getting. You're getting the 6'7 guy who plays with real physicality, great bloodlines, right? He's athletes all over his family. And he's a team player. That I really like about how he played at Arizona, where he didn't need to be the guy all the time. He played a team game, good passer, was selfless, crashing the boards, doing whatever to win. And once again, we're learning it's good to have winners around. And I think with Koa Pete, you know the type of physical specimen you're getting, the power that he plays with, the selflessness that he has. And before the reconstruction, he was pretty good in the mid-range, a good mid-range shooter who you start to look at offensively, he has some upside there too. It's just there's a huge question mark about the jumper now that is completely unanswerable because we don't know what the final product is going to look like. And I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, the jumper was already a question, and now it's just a massive question at this point. And that's pretty scary for a guy who may be one of those players who's just a dog, plays hard, rebounds, defends multiple positions, makes the right decision as a passer, and makes a winning impact. But he is a bit undersized. There's no guarantee that he ends up being a star in those any of those categories. And so I think it's pretty important for Pete that he's at least, you know, a solid standstill shooter. I'd love to see that from him. Otherwise, you're talking about an undersized five type of guy. And like, I think that Knicks fit, I've had him in a bunch of different mocks going to the Knicks because it's like, oh, this would be perfect. Play next to Cat. Cat can be a floor spacer for you offensively. Cat can be more of the interior guy, and Coapeak can, you know, be the tough guy off ball defensively, and it could work. But I think fit's going to be very important for him. And I mean, on the note of the Knicks, it's going to be interesting to see if there's any teams in the early 20s that decide to move up. I've heard Detroit at number 21, the Sixers at number 22, and the Knicks at number 24 are teams that are three teams that teams are looking at as potentially trying to move up into the mid late teens. I think OKC at 17, Charlotte at 18 are some of the spots that teams are really trying to target to move up into. And but like there's competition. Phoenix, New Orleans, these teams that are trying to trade into the draft as well are targeting those late teens picks as well. So like the board as it is today could change a lot by next week. The Giannis stuff, other trades, pre-draft, and obviously draft night trades. So much can change. We'll be right back. Albert, next thing I want to do with you, I didn't tell you we were going to do this, but I want to have a little fun with it. Grade my player comparisons. I got my 10 favorite player comparisons in my draft guide this year. Some of these are comparisons that people think are stupid. Other ones are ones that I just personally like. I want you to give me a grade A, B, C, D, F, whatever grade you want to give it. So we're going to go through some of these. Here are my 10 favorite NBA draft player comparisons, starting with Cam Boozer as Pistons Blake Griffin, his last all-star appearance in his career in late 2010s. Blake Griffin was no longer the lob threat, the dunk machine, the guy who jumped over the car. He was bully ball shot creator who got wherever he wanted on the floor. He made threes at a career high rate, a higher volume, hit a ton of game-winning jumpers over the course of the season. He came off screens. He shot off the dribble. He backed guys down from the mid post. He faced up. He was a complete offensive package player that could beat you in so many different ways. And I have a hard time thinking of guys historically who are around 6 foot eight, who aren't elite leapers like this version of Blake Griffin wasn't, and guys who are 250 plus pounds with skill. And there's not a lot of them. And so that's why for Cam Boozer, I look at specifically this version of Blake Griffin late in his career as a comparison for Cam Boozer.
I think the reason why people might like hate on that comp is just because you're talking about Blake like late end of his prime. So people that will like stick in their minds and be like, oh, how are you comparing this kid to like some guy towards the end of his road? But I totally get it. And I think the most important point that you made was that Griffin at that point was taking threes and he was making threes, right? Which is a really important part of Cam Boozer's game.
Seven per game, Albert. That year.
Yeah.
And if we get 36%.
If we get Boozer taking seven or more per game, which is a real possibility, then I totally get the comp. And Boozer was at like what, 35, 36 inch max vert at the combine. So Blake Griffin coming down from his athletic peak was probably at that range still.
So exactly. It makes sense. so you like the comp?
I like the comp a lot. Just, you know, you have to take it out of the age stuff and the prime stuff. Yes. I'll say, let's go with A minus. How about that?
Thank you. I much appreciate that. That's much better than all the comments online and all the the SKOC stuff from the draft guide. A lot of like, you're a dummy. You're a dummy for the Blake Griffin comp. I can't read this anymore. All right, next one. Let's look in the past again. This is a player in his prime that reminds me of Darren Peterson. prime Ray Allen as a comparison for Darren Peterson. I think the Ray Allen version of the Bucks and the Sonics, when he was at his peak athletically, he wasn't just the off-ball weapon like he was in Boston or Miami. He was a guy who could create off the dribble, get to the rim a bit, get into his mid-range jumper. I think Darren Peterson, this is sort of the formula with what he showed both at Prolific Prep in high school, more on-ball stuff, but also off-ball at Kansas, where he was just an absolute demon off the catch, coming off of curls, getting into actions. I think that's what he could look like moving forward in the NBA as a prime Ray Allen.
People are going to think just because I'm a guest on your show that I'm here and just agreeing with everything that you're saying. But there is proof to what I'm about to say. My partner, Corey Tullivan, and I, on our pod, Corey compared him to Ray Allen back in the summer, right before the season even started. And on my Twitter account about a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago, I did a mix of Ray Allen highlights from when he was on the Sonics. And I asked Draft Twitter, I was like, who does this remind you guys of? And the reason why I put that out there was because of Darren Peterson. I totally get the comp. And I think if fans out there don't really understand it, it might be that, and I'm not hating, right? But you might just be too young to remember prime Ray Allen. You know, like for Corey and I, we're in our late 30s now. So we remember what Ray Allen looked like back in the day and the type of scorer that he was, both with, you know, the Sonics and the Bucks and whatever. And maybe some of the younger fans just remember Miami Ray Allen and that clutch jumper he hit in the finals, and maybe even some of the stuff in Boston. But I get it. Ray Allen was a great athlete, a guy coming out of UConn who you could put the ball in his hands to go be your, during that time in the 90s, your prototypical shooting guard. But he was taking threes and he had the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful jumpers you'll ever see with a lightning quick release. So I totally get the comp. Obviously, the size stuff is there too. It's just for me, I'm still dreaming that maybe there's an even higher ceiling with Darren Peterson. But in terms of the actual comp, it's one that we've been saying as well. So for me, selfishly, because we made the same comp, I'll say an A.
Thank you. I like it. Next one, maybe this one you won't like quite as much considering how much praise you've given to Caleb Wilson. Caleb Wilson comparison, healthy Jonathan Isaac. If everything had worked out with Jonathan Isaac, if he had stayed healthy, never suffered all the injuries, Jonathan Isaac in that 2017 draft, I remember, you know, Jonathan Charks loved Jonathan Isaac because he was 6'11", 7'1" wingspan, you know, could defend across positions. He was effective off ball as a menace, versatile on ball. He could hit spot up jumpers, you know, showed potential off the dribble as well. And they have similar types of bodies. And I just think about, what if Jonathan Isaac had stayed healthy? Maybe that's what Caleb Wilson could look like in his career.
I get it. I totally get it just because of the, okay. If Isaac didn't have the injury stuff, I think this conversation would feel way different. And that's why you said a healthy version of Jonathan Isaac. But I think people have to understand, like, if Jonathan Isaac was healthy, he would be like first or second team all defense every single year. He was that type of prospect and is still that type of defensive player when he's healthy. I get my only counter, the only counter that can even come to mind for me with Caleb is one, like I mentioned earlier, the passing chops with Caleb, I think, are really, really high end. And if he can flash more of that in the NBA, then I think we're talking about a slightly different tier in terms of how his NBA future and outlook looks like. But I obviously don't hate the comp here, so I'll say let's go with a B here. I think that's fair.
I think that's fair too. I mean, with Caleb Wilson, understandably so, you're hoping for something more, and that is the one thing Wilson has that Isaac sort of missed at the time. Well, it was that creation ability as a potential primary within the flow of the offense. I mean, with Isaac, I remember, you know, Charks and I would go back and forth about him at the time, and he felt more strong about Isaac than I did. I think I had Isaac fifth on my board, if I remember correctly, that year. And I think Charks had him like three, something like that, if I remember correctly. I was all about Tatum that year. He was all about Isaac and OG Anunoby. I remember he loved both those guys. I think, who didn't love OG Anunoby? OG was awesome as a prospect coming out of the draft. Granted, he tore his ACL. Speaking about Tatum, my next comparison here, AJ DiBonsa compared to Jason Tatum. Now, this one specifically, you can look at it like wide, right? Like wide as in like big 6'9", do-it-all player. I'm thinking specifically about how when Tatum entered the league, there was questions about, Is he just too mid-range heavy? Is he going to be able to develop the three? Is he going to be an effective defender with that body and his dimensions? He should be way better defensively than he was at Duke. And it just reminds me so much of the DiBonsa conversation now, where it's the same exact questions. Is it too much mid-range? Why does he not get more blocks and steals? And with Tatum, what did he become? A five-tool positionless defender. He can defend every position. There's like, you can put him on guards, put him on wings. He can play a little small five for you. And then offensively, his playmaking has improved dramatically. He's become a far more effective three-point shooter. And with AJ DiBonsa, I just see that similar path to success for him in the years to come.
This is a tough one. This is actually a really tough one for me, just because of everything you said about the player that Tatum has become. Like, offensively, obviously, he's an absolute engine of a player, and you're hoping that DiBonsa becomes that. But also with Tatum, like, his rebounding is unbelievable. He's such a strong rebounder. You mentioned the growth of his playmaking. He's become such a good passer as well. And then defensively, what Tatum brings you every single night, plus the rebounding, is what makes him such a special NBA star. Now, with DiBonsa, that's what you're hoping for, right? That he becomes, if you're going to take him with the number one pick in the draft, you're hoping he gets to that level of a Jason Tatum, especially in this type of class. It's just, there is a lot of room for AJ to grow and to get to that level as both a playmaker, a rebounder, and a defender. I really like AJ's potential as a defender. I think on ball, he had really good moments, but off the ball at times at BYU, there were some real lapses there. And like, you just want more defensive playmaking from him. Like, if you look at the stocks, the stock numbers with him, it's like, it leaves you wanting more. So depending on where he ends up, yeah, I think it's an outcome that is definitely possible for him. I just don't know if I'm like 100% ready to be like, he's going to get to Jason Tatum's level, just because Tatum has become such an all-world basketball player. It's a tough one. In terms of the comp, because of what you're dreaming AJ would become, I'll go B-plus on it. It's just that I really do believe AJ still has a lot of work to get to that level.
Next up, Darius Acuff compared to Jamal Murray. And the reasons for this one is because with Jamal Murray, a bit of a sturdier frame like Acuff has. Obviously, Murray paired with Jokic all these years has been both an on-ball and off-ball guy. And I think this hits on the conversation around Acuff. He's not just an on-ball, you know, ball in my hands, I'm doing nothing else guy. Arkansas used him off screens and handoffs. He made about 50% of his catch and shoot threes last year. I think he's a very talented off-ball scorer, and I don't know where he's going to land in the draft, but I hope he lands on a team where he's playing with other creators, where it really pushes him to play off-ball while also leaning on his on-ball gifts in the same way Murray has been fortunate to do playing next to Jokic.
I think the most popular comp for Acuff on the internet is like Stephon Marbury. And I don't really like that comp at all, just because like I get it. Like, there's something with the frames that are similar.
That's the other one in my draft guide. I have Marbury. So you can give that one an F and Murray a better grade.
I won't give it an F because I get it. It's just that I don't agree is where I'm landing with Marbury. Because like, Marbury was this like physical downhill guard who, you know, some of the off the court stuff wasn't great with him and how he clashed with KG, blah, blah, blah. And just, you know, I didn't really love how his career turned out. The Jamal Murray one makes a lot more sense. And the reason why I like it is because of what you mentioned, their builds, the scoring ability, three levels. If you put Acuff next to another primary creator, like, that might be his best role, honestly. Not to say that he can't be the engine, but he might be even better as like a 1B rather than a 1A, just because some of the size stuff with him. But I get it. The only thing that I think he has over Murray is I think he's a better passer. And I think that's a real thing with Acuff, and he really showed that at Arkansas this year. I think Acuff, and my partner Corey Tullibus says this all the time, but I think Acuff is the best lob thrower in this class. He's an exceptional passer that really got to, you know, flash that this year. And so I get it. I think this is a good comp. I'll go with A- on this one, just because I really am not a fan of the Marbury one.
Next up, this is a player you mentioned you have a hard time with, Adai Mara. Adai Mara this year showed off a lot of playmaking skill at Michigan. He posted the highest assist percentage of any college player 7'2" or taller, according to Bart Torvik. The player he surpassed was Roy Hibbert's 2008 season at Georgetown. And so Adiamara as a comp to Roy Hibbert, in part because of that passing feel as a mammoth-sized big man, interior player. And I think Hibbert, there was a time in the NBA where he got phased out, but the bigs are back. And with Adiamara, I think there's room for him to be a Hibbert type of player and modernized form in today's NBA.
I think this is an A++++.
Wow.
Just because for me, it's with him. My thing with Mara is like, yeah, I said I had a hard time with him, but also part of this that I've been thinking about a lot recently, and I don't want to jinx him. This is a true knock on wood type of moment, but I do wonder about some of the health stuff with Mara, like the way that he's built. When you watch him run up and down the court, there are some question marks about if he's going to have like the longevity that you want. And so my thing is this, if Roy Hibbert played in the NBA now, I think he'd be like an excellent second big or first big off of your bench type of guy. I think he'd be great in that role. And with Mara, my brain keeps going back and forth where he could be a center who plays, you know, 28 to 32 minutes per game, or like an amazing backup who runs your second unit, could be an offensive hub. I know people who love Mara are going to hate this take from me, and I get it. It's just I have so many question marks about the player and the health and the size and all that stuff. Also being 7'3", 260 is a lot on the joints. And he's kind of like one of these like long leg, short torso kind of looking guys. He's kind of high waisted. I have a lot of question marks, and I know people won't agree with me, but comparing him to Roy Hibbert and how Hibbert would play in the NBA today, I think that's an A++ comp.
I mean, I've given you my good comps. There's plenty of bad comps in the guy. These are my favorites for a reason. There's a lot of tough comps. This one I'm a little iffy on, actually, and that's Merez Johnson to Isaiah Stewart. And the reason why is because I almost feel stronger about what Merez Johnson could be, but I have a hard time thinking of a better comparison for him than Isaiah Stewart. With Stewart, he figured out how to shoot threes. He's an interior bruiser. He's a rebounder, a very versatile defensive player. And there's just not a lot of guys that check those boxes in the ways that Merez Johnson does. What do you think about that Isaiah Stewart, Merez Johnson comp? And do you have a better one?
No, this is unfortunate because we made a similar comp on our pod. And I get it. I think with Stewart, the only thing is Stewart's a little crazier. And I'm not crazy for saying that. It's just a real thing. Like, he's a little wilder, but Merez Johnson is every bit the competitor that Isaiah Stewart is. And I think that needs to be mentioned. Obviously, with Merez, like the size with him, the lateral ability, the length, just how he played, how he attacks the boards, a guy who finishes everything at the rim. My hope is that I think he's going to be a better player than Isaiah Stewart, and why I'd feel comfortable taking Merez Johnson even within like the top 12. That's a no problem thing for me because I just think he's that good of a prospect. And once again, like the shooting, I think it's there. I think it'll happen. He's just got to take more of them. He didn't take a ton of them. He took like zero his freshman season. And then this past year, he took a little bit more, but we just want to see more of that volume because I think the mechanics are there. So this one, I'll go B+.
Next one. Ibuka Okori compared to Tyrese Maxey. And I think it's in part because they're both small, downhill attackers, rim pressure. And as we talked about previously, I'm a believer in Okori's jumper becoming a knockdown level in the same way that Tyrese Maxey has developed over time.
Maxey's the dream outcome for Okori, obviously. And I loved Maxey when he was coming out of Kentucky, a guy that I was just absolutely enamored with. And I was like, watching him, I'm like, oh, he's going to be a shooter. He's going to be a shooter. Like, I had no doubt about it, even though he didn't shoot it well in college. For Okori, it might be the same situation where he wasn't lights out as a shooter in college, but I think we're both believers in the jumper. And if the jumper is going to be as good as we think it's going to be, then Maxey's a real potential outcome. And the thing, and another person to kind of throw in the mix is like, what if he's like smaller Donovan Mitchell? I think that's a real outcome as well with how Mitchell plays and the shooting and the downhill ability, the athleticism, right? Okori's a real deal athlete, like the quickness in tight spaces. He's another one of these guys that's kind of like a prime running back who's good between the tackles, can hit the A gap, B gap, but you know, he can like really study where he wants to go and make that decision. I think that's a good one. I'll say I'll go straight A on this one.
Next up, Allen Graves to Lamar Odom. Allen Graves, freshman, came off the bench at Santa Clara last year. Sixth man for them. He had struggles against quad one and quad two teams, but high feel, grew up playing point guard. I see point forward-ish potential, maybe not to the extremes of Lamar Odom, but I just think a 6'8", 7-foot wingspan, Graves, the feel for the game reminds me a little bit of an Odom type of player, being like a star role player.
Okay, so we've been on a run of me giving you A's and B's. It's just as a native New Yorker, born and raised, I live in LA now, but I spent 28 years in New York. I grew up idolizing Lamar Odom, a guy who never played for the, or did he play for the Knicks? Well, no, he was on the Knicks roster, never played at the end. But a guy who, his ability with the ball in his hands, the creativity and swagger that Lamar Odom had, and the special passer that he was, I like almost try my best to never compare him to anyone, because I think he was such an anomaly to be 6'10", and the role that he found eventually with the Lakers as like their third banana was so special. And what he offered them defensively too, I get it. Like Graves, the thing is, like, he was a defensive playmaker this year. The steal percentage, block percentage is high, but I don't know if like I'm like a full believer in that yet. I don't think he has the creativity and the ball handling that Lamar Odom has. So I'm going to go D on this one, because I get the allure with Graves. I totally do. But I just think Lamar was such a unique prospect and player that it's hard for me to make that comp.
My other comp in there is Dario Saric for Allen Graves, which isn't a perfect one either. I don't love either of the comps for Allen Graves. This next one I feel like everybody has, but it's still one of my favorites. Jaden Quaintance to Mitchell Robinson, lob threat, just an incredibly, you know, high elite leaper guy, versatile defensive player. Questions about how many minutes he'll be able to play at the NBA level, but who knows? With his length, strength, he might be the type of guy grabbing clutch offensive boards in the final minutes of an NBA Finals game.
I think this is like one of the hardest players to comp in the whole class. Mm-hmm. And it sounds weird because people are going to be like, well, he's 6'9", 6'10", you know, he plays physical, rebounds, like what's so hard? I just feel like with him, he's another one of these like really unique movers. To be as big and as strong as he is, and to see him move laterally in person, I remember at the Nike Hoop Summit a couple years back when he was there, watching him in drills, I'm like, this is not normal stuff. Like when he was guarding smaller guys, he's like there all day in their shirt, moving with them side to side. I'm like, this is some freakish stuff. But then to your point about the health stuff, there are some real red flags. And some of the whispers that we're hearing about how his medicals have been looking is terrifying to think about, right? To, I mean, what if his career never really gets off the ground in the way people think? I think it's a scary one. The only thing with Mitch is that he's like 7'1" or 7 foot. And so I think there is a little bit of a difference in height. But in terms of role, I can see that. I'd say Quaintance is a better lateral mover, and you can actually see him out guarding guards and wings a little bit more. So I'll say, let's go B minus on this one.
That's a good one. I think that's a fair grade. And that's enough of player comparisons to the real reason why I wanted to bring you on today. Real quickly, I have quite enjoyed your in the car draft prospect breakdowns. You and I clearly have one thing in common besides a love for basketball, and that is a love for self-driving cars. Are you on Tesla versions of V14? Albert?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
V14. as I mentioned on the podcast last week, I posted a video of myself driving back from New York to Boston talking about how Mitch Johnson just completely choked away game 4 of the NBA Finals. And, you know, there's a lot of comments like, ooh, wow, you're using self-driving. And then there's occasional comment like, this is unsafe behavior. But, you know, I don't drive anymore, Albert. I'm at 99% usage on Tesla full self-driving ever since V14 launched. I do not drive. I don't. I pretty much just choose a parking spot. I park in my garage, and that's about the extent of it at this point. And I feel like I'm living in the future. in many regards, because I think it's a type of thing, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, with Tesla self-driving. It is not something you can watch a video and understand. It's not something you can read about or see the stats about how incredibly safe it is. It is only something that can be experienced. So I'm curious about what you're experiencing with FSD, and also what your percentage is. Am I just an outlier nerd geek? Yes, I am, but I'm just curious what yours.
I think like the biggest vote of confidence I can give to this is that when I have my wife and daughter in the car, I'm not driving. Full self-drive yeah. all the way. I trust the livelihood of myself and my family. It's Same become here. That good. And it's just ridiculous. Like the way that it reads everything on the road, the way that it reacts, even like when like ambulances or cop cars are going by, it knows to pull over to the side and wait that out. Like it's so wildly advanced. And I know like everyone's like riding Waymos right now. And I'm like, look at these Waymos that need like a million different things attached to it for it to be effective. And Tesla just has like a bunch of like cameras and radars or whatever. It's special stuff. And to your point about me doing the video series, it was just like, you know, I talk in the car all the time, whether I'm on the phone or I'm not normal. I'll talk to myself sometimes. But and I was like, you know what? Why not just record
talk,
it?
Talk to Grok. Just talk to Grok in the car.
Or that.
I've had some long combos in the car with Grok.
And I was like, you know what? Let me get some of my draft thoughts out there, record it while I'm self-driving. And, you know, if you watch the videos, my eyes are mostly on the road, 90% on the road. And I try my best. And in terms of my stats, I think I'm only at like 75%. And I think part of that is like sometimes like in my garage, it'll get confused and just like park wherever it wants when I have a designated spot. So I'm trying to figure that out right now. But yeah, I love it. It's been great. And I trust my family's livelihood with it. So that says it all.
I mean, I think you nailed it there. I mean, that's the funny thing is with like my mother. So she doesn't drive right now. Granted, she will be using FSD at some point. She plans on it once we have a second car. So I bring her around places and she prefers, and I'm a good driver. I'm a very good driver. I've always been like somebody who's not overly aggressive. I don't get annoyed. I'm a good driver. And she much prefers Tesla FSD to me. And I prefer Tesla FSD to me. It is a far superior driver. I remember I took my friends into Boston a few times, and they're like, you know, darting their head back and forth at like a stop, you know, like waiting for cars. And I'm just like, ho-hum, waiting for the car. And they're like, wow. You know, there's like a trash barrel in the middle of the road. It like just flawlessly yeah. goes around smoothly. It is truly, I think, the most magical piece of technology that I have ever used in my life. And I look forward to the day that it's mainstream and people, this is normal for people, because there will be a generation of kids that grow up with Waymos and grow up with robo-taxis, and it's a normal yeah. thing for them. And someday I think it'll be make the roads a safer place and a more enjoyable place. I will say on the last thing here before I get to go, I got another recording I got to get to. On the way back from Boston or New York, I saw a man with like a monitor mounted above the Tesla screen. Like he had a second monitor mm-hmm. mounted. And I saw a girl with like a like, you know, an airplane neck pillow, just chilling, you know, just chilling. That's the future. Meanwhile, I rewatched the second half of the NBA finals. So yeah, and ate my sweet green salad.
Really quickly, like a follow-up story to what you're saying, like me and my buddies went to the Cosm here in LA to go see The Matrix like a month ago, and I had like three of them in my car, and we just FSD'd the whole way there. And it got to the parking lot, it stopped at the little thing where you pick up your ticket.
Yeah,
it drove so all the way into the parking lot, found a parking spot, and my friends were all just, their jaws were on the floor and they couldn't believe that it did all that. So I get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's really only something that could be experienced. There's no going back for me. But Albert, this is a hell of a lot of fun, man. I really, really enjoy everything you guys do at No Ceilings. You guys have built something really special. You guys just released your draft guide as well, available on No Ceilings. People can check that out on the Substack. And of course, people have to check out your YouTube page as well. So keep up the great work, Albert. You guys have a really awesome thing going. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Big thank you to Albert Gim for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the whole team for producing today's show. We'll be back again later in the week with more podcasts, talking about the draft, talking about the upcoming offseason. Have a good day, everybody.